I'm Izzy Judd, and welcome to my podcast, Let's Talk Fertility. This podcast is sponsored by Pregnacare. During my own fertility treatment and pregnancies, I was recommended to take specialist vitamins and minerals to support my nutritional needs. There are many benefits to taking these supplements, and they also made me feel like I was taking a proactive approach to prepare myself and my body as best I could. Pregnacare Conception and Wellman Conception vitamin and mineral supplements provide advanced nutritional support for men and women trying for a baby, including zinc, vitamin D, and the exact levels of folic acid recommended for women by the UK Department of Health. Pregnacare, expert nutritional care while trying for a baby. To find out more, visit www.pregnacare.com. So my guest today is fertility and women's health expert Emma Cannon. Emma is a registered acupuncturist, founder of the Emma Cannon Clinic, as well as a mentor and speaker. With over 20 years in clinical practice from her fertility rooms, many individuals and couples come to Emma for her unique approach to support all aspects of female and male fertility. She has helped countless patients achieve their dream of having a family. Emma has written many books, including Fertile, which personally supported me through IVF. The book nurtures you as a whole, from the food you eat right through to your emotional well-being. It was a very influential part of my experience, and it helped me to start thinking about fertility in a different light. It not only gave me support, but also belief that there was something proactive I could do to help myself be as prepared as possible, mentally and physically, for IVF. Emma's holistic approach is refreshing and inspiring, and I'm sure will make us all take a step back and realise the importance of living a fertile life, how to learn to nourish ourselves from the inside out, and in the words of Emma, be the gardener tending to the soil. So welcome, Emma. It's lovely to have the chance to sit and chat with you today. And I just wondered, sort of going back right to the start of your career, what interested you in the first place to become a fertility expert?
Oh, well, first of all, it's lovely to be here and thank you for having me and thank you for the very kind introduction and the opportunity to talk about my most favourite subject. and the question was, what got me into fertility?
Yeah, where did you...
Where did I start with it? Well, actually, when I look back, it was a really natural progression because I grew up in a household of women. I am one of five sisters, and someone always was pregnant or had a period in my house. So,
were you in sync?
Yes, and I went to a girls' boarding school, and we were definitely in sync there. It was not pretty. So I kind of grew up around periods and babies and heartbreak and all of that stuff. So I think I was very well placed to support women, and I had. Decided to become an acupuncturist in the very early 90s, having been made redundant from my oil business job. And so I retrained as an acupuncturist, having looked into various different things that I thought one might be interested in. And a piece of research came out. It was a German piece of research looking at the role of acupuncture in IVF. And suddenly I started to get a lot of fertility patients come and they were getting pregnant. So I got myself a bit of a reputation for being the baby maker.
Okay, fascinating. Because as we've spoken about, although I didn't see you for treatment during the time, unfortunately, I didn't know, which I'm gutted about because I would have absolutely loved to have seen you. But I obviously discovered your book, Fertile, just as I was about to go through IVF. And I literally set to with my highlighter. I've shown you the book, made loads of notes. And as I read through the book, it made so much sense to me on a human level. I think I had only really looked at my fertility from a medical perspective rather than, more of a personal. I guess I found having that a plan, with the meal planner, but also the emotional support for me was invaluable. And I just want to say thank you because, obviously you were there in spirit for me, even if not physically there. So I just want to say, you know, thank you so much. And I'm sure you've been a support to so many. But recently you've launched 90 Days Fertile, which is a digital program online, which basically explains about the five pillars of fertility. And I've heard you talk about these pillars as ingredients for a fertile life. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about these ingredients.
Okay. Yeah. My five pillars of fertile. So it starts with flexibility, and flexibility is all about, it's like being a pioneer. You're about to set off on a journey, and you're going to have lots of adventures in front of you. And it's really about how you deal with the obstacles that come your way. Yeah. Because I think what happens is people set off on their journey, and sometimes they fall at the first hurdle, or they get something happens, and then they go straight into fear. And then they think, okay, this is never going to happen. I've read all these terribly negative stories out there in the press, and I've seen, you know, many women go through it, and they go straight into fear. So this is more like saying, no, you're going to set off on a journey, and like any journey you go on, there may be obstacles along the way, and it's how we deal with these obstacles that really helps us grow. So instead of putting an enormous amount of control over everything, I encourage people to bring more flexibility. And about having vision, so sort of knowing where you're going. And it's a bit like I have a little totem animal that goes with each pillar as well. And the one for this is the eagle. And the eagle, I chose the eagle because the eagle has amazing vision. The eagle can see the big view of it, what it's looking at, but it can also hone in and see the minutiae, the tiny. And that's what you've kind of got to be like. You've got to keep the bigger picture and be able to zoom in on the detail when you need to. And I think what happens in fertility when you begin to struggle is you just end up on the tiny, tiny details, or you sort of catastrophize and think of things that haven't really happened yet. So that's my first one. And a lot of women struggle with control. They're very controlling over things, and it creates a lot of rigidity in the body. So it's replacing control with flexibility. The next one is creativity, and that's all about the kind of work of the heart. It's all about joy and passion and creativity. And it's this idea that babies are part of our creativity. So it's really important not to lose the joy in your life in the pursuit of having a baby. And I think, again, that can really happen, is that we become very single-minded, nothing else exists, all the joyful things in our life go out of the window, and pretty soon people have created quite a joyless life for themselves.
Just to stop you there for a moment, there's a painting in your clinic.
There is.
From a lady that you suggested that she picked up painting again.
Yes.
And I just think that is such a wonderful thing, and that it's now a beautiful, like a vase of flowers that's up in your clinic.
Yeah. So that's my sort of classic creativity story. And there are hundreds actually like that. And there's one about a piano, and there's lots of stories that I can tell to demonstrate that. But this was particularly lovely because she'd had two children, but she struggled for 4 years to have the next one. And really had lost sight of who she was. And it wasn't that she didn't love her children. Of course she loved her children. Of course she knew she was really lucky to have her two children. But she had really lost that connection to herself. And that's what happened. She went and did a painting course and fell pregnant on the painting course. And that was it.
Well, I mean, it suggests you talk about it in Fertile as well. And for me, the joy I lost was playing my violin. You know, I'm a trained musician, and I've played my violin all my life, but in that time I didn't take my violin out of its case.
Wow.
Until I embarked on IVF and decided that I was going to pick up and play my violin. And it's amazing how connecting with something that's so instinctive for you and so important, and you can say 1,000 words through, playing the violin without having to say a word. So, yeah, that's definitely something I absolutely relate to.
I get goosebumps when you said that, so I know it's truth. but yeah, that's all about losing connection with yourself, isn't it? So I think for me, that having awe and wonder, having passion, connecting back to yourself, I think they're really important.
Absolutely. So flexibility, creativity.
Nourishment. So nourishment is kind of everyone's favourite because everybody is obviously obsessed with food, as am I. but I am not as rigid as people would think. I think people think that, you know, you can eat 10 fertile foods and, you know, and then hey presto, baby's going to come out. I'm actually much more interested in, yes, what you eat, but why you eat and how you eat and how good you are at receiving the nourishment from that food. Because I promise you, the people that come and see me that think they have the healthiest diet are the ones that have the most unhealthy relationship with food. And we all know the sort of people that we're talking about, for who the joy of food has gone out, and there is so much rigidity around it and so much denial and so much, I don't eat this, I won't eat that, and la, 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 that it just becomes another battleground in your life. If that's what you want, I am not your person. Because for me, the more rigidity around food, the more problematic it is. So food is supposed to be joyful. It is supposed to nourish us, but it's supposed to nourish us emotionally as well as physically. Yeah. So yes, it's important to have a good food, but there are so many books out there and they all conflict. I think likely it's, you know, it's an individual thing. I think the food that you grew up eating sometimes has an impact on that. I grew up in Germany. I ate a lot of sauerkraut. I've always kind of liked all those pickles and things like that. If you look at the research, they always come back to the Mediterranean diet, probably because there's a lot of vegetables in it. There's good quality oils. There's some fish, oily fish, and the small amount of meat, which for some people is important. I know a lot of people are vegans and vegetarians now, and that's fine. It's quite hard to have a balanced diet on a vegan diet. And what I actually find very difficult is not that there's a problem with the vegan diet, but sometimes people are using it as a way to be very controlling about their food. So they already have underlying eating disorders or a bad relationship with food, and then they use very rigid food, you know, diets to kind of feed into that. So one of the things I see a lot of in clinic is people who've adopted very extreme diets and very extreme exercise regimes, and that their periods stop. So this idea of nourishment is, it is about what you eat, but it's about how well you absorb the nutrients from what you eat.
There are certain foods that will help support you through an IVF cycle. I mean, I know I joke in my book about how much beetroot risotto I ate.
Yeah.
Which actually, it was really yummy. I love beetroot. I ate a lot of but is there some connection between that in terms of how the food we might help support us?
Yeah, there definitely is. And, you know, I sort of play devil's advocate in this because I think the role for food can and is being overstated. You know, when you look at things like the mind, but of course it's one of my pillars of health. So of course it would be ridiculous to say that food isn't important. And I think one of the problems is that because doctors have not got on board at all with how important food is, the extreme end is happening, and there are people out there making too many claims about the benefits of food. But of course, I'm a big fan of chicken broth. I'm a big fan of beetroot, as you know. I think leafy green vegetables. What we do in the clinic is we sit down with the individual and kind of make suggestions as to what's helpful for them. But during an IVF cycle, what I look at is foods that nourish the blood. So in Chinese medicine, we have this idea of foods that nourish blood, and they tend to be foods very rich in protein, which research has shown is important. The beetroot, of course, the leafy green vegetables, the chicken broth, things like that. Mm-hmm. And not a fan of the smoothies, too cold, it's too, you know, and juicing, I find it to be, Yeah, well, you need the fibre. So definitely with juicing, you're not getting the fibres. So it's more about warm food, cooked food, nourishing food, quite comforting food, really. And there is research around milk, and I know a lot of people avoid milk, and that's absolutely fair enough if you can't tolerate lactose. But there is good research about having milk, and some of the clinics actually advocate drinking quite a large amount of milk as well.
Yeah. Because as you're saying here, it's not if I do this, then I will get this result.
Yeah.
To have that mentality, it puts even more pressure on already a time where you're already under enormous pressure. For me personally, it was building a picture around me of all taking all these little bits of advice and putting them all together. And by combining all those different things, helped me feel better within myself. It wasn't because I believed that would give me the outcome I wanted, because nobody could tell me what the outcome was going to be. But it was how it made me feel.
Absolutely.
During the process. And I think that's where it's so important to go into a round of IVF feeling that.
Yeah.
And when you're saying about comforting food, all those sorts of things help. I mean, I remember coming back from my embryo transfer and saying to Harry, please, all I want is a sausage sandwich. It was all I wanted. I just wanted a crusty baguette with loads of tomato ketchup and sauce. And I just wanted, that was, I just
remember. And that never killed anyone.
No, and he went and he did get it. So anyway, so we've done three.
Yeah, just say. One last thing about that. And I think that is absolutely it. But it is so much about your relationship with the food that you're eating and about how well you absorb the nutrition from it. And I think if you've made the food, you've chosen the food, you've engaged in the food, you've cooked the food, you know, that is such a lovely process. And that is what I mean by nourishment.
And something I did with Harry, we enjoyed the
lovely
food together.
Yeah.
And it made me feel, you know, again, that we were a team in this. And, and he supported me with this and the shopping list and all those sorts of things.
And it's something you can do. There's a lot of it you can't do, but you can do that.
Yeah.
So the next pillar is transformation. This is one of my personal favourites, because this is about how we turn our wounds into wisdom. Mm-hmm. And this idea that things will happen to us that are difficult and sad. And we have a choice. You know, we can either let those things break us, or we can actually transform those into wisdom and to give us a depth, mm-hmm. and to even better to sort of take that wisdom into the world. So this is, you know, it's that idea that I think we set out when we're younger, and maybe the generation we grew up where it was pretty coveted, you know, we were protected. And I think we just thought bad stuff didn't really happen. Mm. And I think you start on the fertility journey and stuff does happen, and there's losses, and there can be, and there can be a lot of sadness, and it can really break you.
Yeah.
So it's about giving people the resources and tools to try and turn those things into wisdom.
Yeah.
And how do we take those into the world? And these are my modern day alchemists, and I've got loads of them as patients. And I look at them and I just think, my God, women are amazing.
Yeah.
And I learn from my patients every day, because of the things that they go through, and they, you know, get themselves up and they face the day again.
Yeah.
And I personally have a belief, having worked with people for all of these years, is that the children that are being born into the world now are going to need lots of resources and lots of skills. You know, maybe the things that we didn't need in so much of, you know, kindness, patience, compassion, tolerance, all of those things. And I think those are the things that you can learn on a difficult fertility journey. And of course, as a parent, you're going to pass those on to your child.
Yeah.
And last but not least, it's belief. And this is all about hope. And I think that that you'll probably recognise this. And people say to me, but I don't want to hope because, you know, hope might let me down, or I'm frightened that hope means nothing. You know, what happens if hope is just, you know, a bottomless pit of despair kind of thing? My response to that is that hope is the antidote to despair. It's the opposite. And if we don't have hope, then really we're in despair. And it's okay to have despair for, you know, when you need it. And it's okay. I would never say to anyone, you know, just pick yourself up, brush yourself down and get on with it. I think allowing yourself to, you know, feel disappointment and all of those things is really important. But at some point, it's about believing that there is a reason for hope, you know. Mm. You know, and going into IVF not with that, oh, well, it's never going to work, you know, da, 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 you know, going into it with an open heart and hope. Mm. So this pillar is all about belief and hope. It's also about self-limiting beliefs. So where do we have, you know, what are our self-limiting beliefs? What's holding us back? You know, do you believe you're not worth thing? You know, I'm not worth it, or that this is happening to me because I had a termination, or all of those stories that we carry around that can be based in nothing, but they become huge and important in our mind when we're not getting to where we want to be getting.
Yeah. I mean, I know completely what you're saying with hope, because Harry, my husband, when we decided to go for a round of IVF, in his eyes, it was the last resort. It was kind of, this is our final. Mm. Now, for me, I said to Harry, I now feel a sense of hope that there is possibility now. For so long, I felt I couldn't do it on my own. I almost had a feeling that I just needed that helping hand. And so for me, going into IVF, to have hope was, and belief was really refreshing.
Yeah.
But it was interesting that Harry was almost reluctant to take the step, because I think he was, yeah, the fear that if it didn't work, then what was left, which again just adds huge pressure.
Absolutely. I mean, and that demonstrates it perfectly, because he had a limiting belief that IVF is the be-all and end-all. Mm. It's the gold standard. And if that wasn't successful, you'd play your trump card and there's no place else to go after that. But that's not true, because people do IVF and it fails and then they fall pregnant the next month. All the time.
Yeah.
You know, so it isn't like that, but that's how we can perceive it in our minds sometimes. And, you know, this just demonstrates that, you know, the mind is mad. The mind tells us all sorts of things all the time, little stories that torture us.
That's it. I mean, I've said through my own experiences that for me, I felt my mind was my biggest hurdle. And even though, you know, I had been diagnosed with polycystic ovaries, I never believed it told the full story. Always believed that kind of my long battle with anxiety and everything else was paying a huge impact on my ability to fall pregnant. And something that you've talked about that really resonates is when you talk about how to live our best fertile life, it's not about having our fertile life for this specific outcome.
That's
right. But actually looking after ourselves as a whole. How would you say is the best way to live our best fertile life, or how do we go about?
Well, I think it's, I mean, that's why I wrote the program, because I think there's something for everybody in each of the pillars. And I think probably what happens is one of those pillars will speak most strongly to somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, in my own life, I use different aspects of those all the time. And I think it really brings balance into my life, because I can be as controlling as the next person, but then I have to check myself and just say, okay, let's try and be flexible here. And I can give up hope sometimes. And then I think, no, what do you tell everybody else? You know, it's like, you know, hope is the antidote to fear. So I think it depends on what stage you're at different times. But that is why I wrote the program, because I felt like it could help everybody in some way at some point.
That's it, because everybody's experience is very unique and everybody feels their experience very differently. And what might be right for one person might not speak to another.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so great about having these five pillars, because as you say, there's something people can pick from one that they might think, yeah, actually,
yeah,
something's not balanced here.
Can I say something about the polycystic ovaries?
Yeah, please.
What really interests me about what you said, and it's really perceptive of you, is that probably the fact that you probably hold your anxiety in your ovaries, you know, that's probably where you store your stress. And it's the same for many, many women. You know, they'll store it in their ovaries. When they feel stressed, they stop ovulating, their periods stop, or you set up a cycle. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, that your anxiety might have manifested through having irregular cycles or polycystic ovaries, and that part of your healing journey was learning to cope with your anxiety. And that's what I mean. It's so individual. It's different for everybody. I have a very active brain. My brain never stops working. So I've had to learn to really control my brain, or to use my brain in a positive way, like channeling all of this work. And sometimes after I write, like I when I wrote the 90 days program and I put it aside and I went back and looked at it 3 months later, I was like, where on earth did all of that come from? I was almost unconscious. So I've had to learn to really harness a part of myself that could work for me for negative or for positive. It could be barren or it can be fertile.
Yeah.
You know, the barren bit of my brain is the never stops, always got, you know, always thinking. And then the fertile part of my brain is like, what can I do to bring this into the world so that it has some positive impact?
When a patient comes to see you,
yeah,
what is the first thing that you try to assess from that patient? What is it that you're, because there might be somebody listening now who is in the depths of that despair and not knowing where to turn next, and they could feel very alone at this time. Mm. I know certainly that was the point I got to. Where do you start? Where do you begin?
Well, I always start with a cup of tea. And I have I have a little tray of tiny little cups, which I've collected over the years, and I offer them to the patient. And I say, which cup would you like? Serious, I do this. It's to show them that they have choices. Yeah? So we start the consultation with a choice. And immediately, someone might have felt like they were running out of choices, you know. But I think there's so much power in choice.
Yeah.
Yeah? At any given moment, we have an opportunity to choose. Mm-hmm. Really annoys me if they say they don't want a cup of tea. I practically thrust it on them. Would you like a cup of tea? No. Oh, you really do. You do. Believe me, you do. So they have a cup of tea, and then we sit down and we have a chat. And we have a chat, and I listen with my ears, but I also listen with my heart. And I listen to what they're not saying. And sometimes I even ask why they don't want a baby, because sometimes it's where there is a conflict within the person that could be causing the problem. Not with everybody, you know, but some people, there's a lot in that. Mm. I don't want a baby because it's going to change my life. It might change my relationship. I had a terrible mother. I had terrible parents. You know, my parents abandoned me. You know, there can be lots of reasons why they do want a baby, but there's a yes but in there somewhere. So sometimes, not always, I might ask that, or I'll look for that. I look for if there's any conflict, and also look for if there's any, you know, exactly as I was saying to you before, polycystic ovaries, or maybe that's, you know, how are you with anxiety? Do you know, da, 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 you know, or sometimes it's not coming from your own anxiety. It might be that you're in a toxic relationship, maybe at work or whatever. So I look, I'm like the detective. I ask all of these questions and I'm sort of trying to piece together a pattern, and I'm trying to see to the heart of it. You know, and sometimes people come and they want something specific out of me. They want a diet, or they want, you know, but it's not always the thing that is going to solve their problem. If diet is central to the problem, then of course I'll fix the diet. But sometimes people want a diet because they don't really want to deal with the thing that's actually going on, which might be they're not having any sex, or, you know, it could be a million things. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to get the information and piece it all together and see where the imbalances lie or where the conflicts lie.
And do you treat men in your clinic as frequently? Do you find...
No.
And do you feel it would actually be really helpful to see both, people in the couple.
For sure. I mean, look, male fertility is definitely on the increase, and we know that male volume of men's sperm has reduced by 50% in 50 years. There's definitely something in our environment that is impacting on male fertility, for sure. Mm. And also lifestyle as well. And yes, I think it's really important. I just think that I'm a female practitioner.
Yeah.
I think that's my strength. I think my whole heritage, my sisters, my daughters, you know what I mean? It's just like, I think I just ooze that kind of, that's what I know. I know women.
Yeah. So then to go into that is almost a completely different...
Yeah, we do treat men.
Yeah.
And they come and have acupuncture and they usually see one of my colleagues, and I think it's really nice when they come together at the beginning. But yes, the question was whether I would see a lot. I don't particularly see a lot. I think that men need support, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not necessarily from me, but they do need support.
They need support. So, Emma, you've been through some of your own tough moments and have spoken about a defining moment when you realised that something had to change. And I think that's something we can all relate to when we suddenly have that moment where it just hits us, that we are just running on empty and something has to shift.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I, for a long time, I sort of prided myself on this amazing sort of service that I was bringing to the world. And I thought, yes, you know, I'm serving all these women and I'm serving my family and, you know, I'm doing this work and it's the work I really want to be doing. And it's never been a question that it was the work that I wanted to do it, but it was the sort of way in which I was doing it. And I think that I really thought that I was in service, but really I was in sacrifice. And I think that this is something that is really relevant to a lot of women. I was really good at giving, but I was very bad at receiving for myself. And so I would, you know, serve all of my patients, and then I'd run across town to make sure that I'd be the one to pick up my daughter from school because I wanted to do the right thing and I wanted to take, you know, pick her up. I think I crashed two cars in that period of time. And, you know, I was putting the perfect dinner on the plate and, you know, on the table, you know, home cooked, everything, you know, beautiful from scratch. And I was just trying to be, like so many of us, I was trying to be, I don't know,
perfect
and just get it all right all of the time. And, you know, I think we pride ourselves in our busyness. I actually now, if someone says to me, oh, you're so busy, it actually makes me feel a bit allergic. I am, and this week particularly, because we've really struggled, but, you know, of course I am busy, but it actually makes me really stop and think then, and I'm just like, okay. You know, and so for me, what happened is I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Well, I crashed three cars or two cars, and then I got diagnosed with breast cancer. And weirdly, the crashing the car led me to finally get diagnosed, because I had a lump on my breast for a long time, and I'd had it checked. I'd been to doctors. I'd even been to one of the big cancer hospitals, and they'd said, no, lumpy boobs, breastfed too long, you know, always sent me away. And of course, I was like roadrunner. I was like, brilliant, out the door as quickly as I could. And then the most terrible thing happened, that they diagnosed me with breast cancer. And it was a really big turning point, because I just thought, how can I have breast cancer? You know, I breastfed my children. I haven't been on the pill. I all of these things that we think might make, and you know, I never even used deodorant. You know, I used to use a crystal or something. You know, I was the original hippie. So I was like, you know, if I can get it, I mean, everybody was shocked. But it was because I wasn't living truly, really. I was really not, it really wasn't an authentic expression of who I was, the way that I was living. I was really living out of step with who I was. And I was a slave. And so I think we women pride ourselves on our busyness and our service, and we can be as grand as we like about, you know, all of these things. And but it, all of it takes maintaining. Mm. And I'm happiest now when I'm in my little caravan in France and I've got a tiny little amount of belongings around me, a few dresses, you know, a couple of crystals.
Yeah.
and I remember...
Cup of tea.
Yeah, cup of tea. Oh, my cups. I spent 3 weeks there this June, and I came back and I came to London. I was like, I have so much stuff.
Yeah.
It's so stressful. Yeah. All of the stuff needs maintaining. The house needs, you know, the plants need water, you know. And I just got this real overwhelm. So I think somewhere in the middle is the truth.
And
you know.
And did going through those experiences change your viewpoint on your treatment and what you were learning about fertility? Did it change
your... Oh, my goodness.
Your...
I mean, my treatments, when you go through difficult times yourself, I mean, I remember one of my old teachers saying to me, you will become a great master after this. Because... it's like what you walk, you know, it's like a spiritual test, you know, it's like walking over coal, you know, and learning to receive for myself was the biggest lesson in that.
Yeah.
You know, instead of giving, receiving for myself. And I say this to women who are in jobs that will take basically everything out of them, is you've got to save something back for yourself, and no one is going to put your health first. You're the only person that can do that.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, and overwork is a massive issue in our society.
You mentioned that you have two daughters yourself, obviously being the mum of a daughter too. I wondered how you approached the conversation of fertility with your girls and what you teach them.
I'm like, it's like Safi. I say to them all the time, you can have a baby soon. And they're like 17. And I think I've been saying it since they're about 15. So it's reverse psychology. Yeah, that's great. But are you going to have a baby?
Yeah.
Have you got your periods yet? If you ask me one more time, Mum, if anyone in my class has got their periods. My poor kids are completely tortured by me. Yes, I'm really open and frank about it.
It's just always been just a normal conversation.
Yes, it's always just been a normal conversation, like it was in my house.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, it's normalising it. Yeah, obviously girls, that's not, don't go out and get pregnant quite yet, but
yeah,
obviously I'll be delighted when it does happen.
When it does happen. And you can always, you've got all the treatment to help and support them through it.
In all seriousness, I teach them that they're periods are the only outward sign they have of their fertility, and that that it's important to develop a relationship with their menstrual cycle. And if their menstrual cycle is not right, you know, to look at what else is going on for them in their lives and what we can, you know, what they need to change and things like that. So the connection between them and their spirit, or I guess their emotions and what they're eating and their periods.
Yeah. One of the toughest times for people going through IVF, and I know for me, was the two-week wait, the dreaded two-week wait. Because until that point, you have appointments to go to. There's always something that's sort of keeping you going. You're going over the hurdles, aren't you? You're reaching that next point during IVF, and then all of a sudden, you're left to go home. And I remember just feeling this overwhelming sense of responsibility that now it was up to me to grow this miracle. And how did I handle that? I wondered what advice you give to your patients during those 2 weeks wait of things that they can do to help support themselves.
Yeah. Well, I've got a really lovely little picture that I give everybody. That's a picture of an implanting embryo. Mm-hmm. And I talk a lot again about this idea about receiving. Now, all that needs to happen is for the embryo, your body, to receive this implanting embryo. And there's little exercises that I give them, you know, the hand on the heart and the hand on the womb, and the feeling connection, the connection between those two places. Every time that you go into your head with the catastrophizing, try and bring it back into feeling positive and in the body. And I really think that at that time, feeling safe is really important. I think do everything you can to banish fear, because honestly, fear is the antidote to to conceiving. Mm-hmm. And anything you can do to laugh and be happy. And there's a wonderful piece of research showing that women who looked at films of clowns — I personally don't like clowns, I find them a bit scary, but obviously work for some people — making them laugh afterwards. So I think, again, that joy, laughter, feeling safe, you know, in terms of our evolution, we would have been designed to have babies when we felt safe, when you're not going to have to run away from a tiger, you know, there's going to be enough calories available for you.
Yeah.
So I think cultivate that feeling of safety and, you know, hunker down the hatches for a couple of weeks, tidy out your knicker drawer, you know, do your wedding album.
That's exactly what I did. I put my wedding album
exactly,
together.
Yeah. Exactly. I think those are perfect. So I always say, watch these films. Ladies in Lavender, I think, is one of them.
Yeah. Lovely music.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Emma, thanks so much for talking to us. It's been fascinating. And I'm just so grateful to have had the chance. And I'm sure the listeners will find it so helpful hearing your amazing words of wisdom. So thanks so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
I know also we've discussed about your 90 Days Fertile. I'm going to put a code up for people to get a discount who've listened. So that's great. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Just before we finish, I just have a couple of just questions that I ask everyone that comes on. So I wondered what your parents taught you about fertility.
Well, my mother taught me that we were the greatest achievements of her life, and that childbirth was painful but worth it.
Right.
So I think that was a really, really positive message. And my father used to tuck me up, and it's not specifically about fertility, but it's about fertile. It's where my fertile thinking comes from. He would tuck me up in bed every night and say, every day and every way, it's getting better and better.
Oh, that's so lovely.
I know.
And what do you feel is the right question to ask somebody going through fertility struggles?
I think that it is individual, but I think it's really important to listen. You know, I think listening and not trying to find solutions where there are none or where you're not qualified to give them is probably one of the most powerful things that you can do.
And what is the kindest thing you can do for yourself when going through fertility struggles?
I think to really not beat yourself up and to give yourself everything you need, give yourself good rest, good food, and all of the things that give you comfort.
Comfort.
Yeah.
And what is your mantra?
Well, it depends. If it's to my children, it's nothing good happens after 3 in the morning and never eat anything blue. But I think mine is to thine own self be true and know yourself.
Thank you, Emma. And just something I just want to finish on, because I know for a lot of people listening who might be going through this, there's a lot emotionally to take on. So I just wanted to do a little mindfulness exercise, and I thought maybe we could share it with the patients at your clinic might like to use it as well.
Oh yeah.
And it's literally very simply, we clasp our thumb with our first finger, then our second, then our third, then our fourth. And as we do, we say the words, calm begins with me. Love begins with me. Hope begins with me. Kindness begins with me.